Legends of Media Research is a podcast series featuring interviews with the media industry's leading researchers, where we go behind the scenes, sharing stories from their greatest achievements and challenges. Brought to you by Media Science, the leader in media and advertising innovation research. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information about Media Science. But for now, I'm your host, Media Science CEO, Dr. Dwayne Varon. Welcome to another exciting episode of Legends of Media Research. Today, I'm actually going to be interviewing a competitor. I'm going to be interviewing Steve Schlesinger, who's the executive chairman of Sago. That's formerly Schlesinger. So that's how many of you will know Steve's company. And Steve is very unique because his entire career is with one company, which is very different from any guest that we've had who typically have gone through a number of companies across their career. We're going to learn a lot about the growth and evolution and the changes that have gone on within what was Schlesinger and became Sago. It's a really fascinating journey into how a market research company grows, adapts, and responds to the changes in the market. So, Steve, welcome to Legends of Media Research.
Thanks, Dwayne. Great to be here with you.
Steve, you're very unique, as I was saying, in that your entire career is with one company, your own. But what people may not realize is that in your case, that actually started for you in one form or another when you were in high school. Let's start with that story. Tell us the story of how you got into this business.
Absolutely. So my mom actually started the company back in 1966 and built it up into a small data collection business, primarily focused on doing quantitative business originally, and then eventually qualitative business in the house I grew up in. And the business literally started from her bedroom to the kitchen to the basement. And that's where it ran for a number of years. Yeah. And it was quite interesting. And I grew up within that environment. And of course, during high school and college, I did odd jobs for her, helping her out, whether it was doing intercept interviews at airports or delivering products for in-home use tests and things like that. So I got my taste early on. And, you know, the joke is always that I was born with a pencil and a clipboard in my hand to do interviews. So I guess I've always been around this stuff since I was a little boy.
And I imagine that if this was being done in your home, there would be those moments where your mom would run to the house and say, okay, everybody be quiet for the next 90 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Focus groups were going on in our family room, and the clients were sitting in the kitchen and watching it on closed circuit TV. And that happened pretty much Monday through Thursday, almost every week. So, you know, at that point in time, I was the last one home of the four of us. And my dad and I would have to skedaddle out to have a little dinner and then sneak back in and go upstairs. So we kept quiet while the groups were going on.
Now, I'm giving a little bit of foreshadowing here, but this company that started in your mother's, you know, family room, I guess, as you would say, eventually would grow on to grow to what is now the Sago Group. You're a global company right now. You've grown so much. Tell us now about where Sago is today. Describe for us really how large this empire that you've built has become.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think of it as a completely transformed company from what it was, let's say, back in the 70s and early 80s. You know, the business now has unbelievable assets across the globe. We're doing probably half our business in qualitative and the other half in quant. We've got a ton of technology and products that we utilize for our clients. And it's just become a more interesting space as time has gone on. I think about, you know, where we were and how we collected information and how we do it today and how we provide that to our clients is vastly different. You know, of course, the digital age, now we're moving into the age of machine learning and AI and how that is sort of becoming part of our methods. And it's as interesting a space as ever and probably more interesting than ever. So, you know, the business has been great. It's continuing to grow and we continue to work to transform it, you know, to make it as relevant as possible for our clients.
So what we want to do now, Steve, is we want to see how that unfolded and how that evolved over the course of these 50 years or whatever. And what we want to do really is think about that really across four stages. That first stage where it was really primarily your mom's business and eventually where you would actually start working for her as an employee. So that phase, the phase where you took over the company from your mom and you continued to kind of like build it as a small shop that would grow to eventually having facilities across four cities, to a stage where you began taking on institutional investment and institutional partnerships. And then, of course, what you really brought in private equity. So we're going to look at how the company changed, kind of like this little Rubik's Cube, you know, with each of these twists that happen in the history of this evolution, how the game changes for you. So let's start first with that era where you were working for your mom, not your high school years, but when you were really like a proper employee, like working for your mom as a legit kind of like researcher.
Yeah. So the first sort of part of that is really my mom saying to me, okay, you want to do this? That's great, because I'm looking to eventually retire. It's something that you could sink your teeth into and take over. And you know, she said, the first thing we're doing is we got to get out of the house, because you can't be coming to work at the house every day. And frankly, we need to grow this business. So, you know, we opened up our first facility and we were off to the races. We had an amazing start in central New Jersey. Originally, a lot of my mother's clients were really primarily what I'll call packaged goods clients, the General Foods and Nabisco's in those days. But when we opened up our first facility, what happened was we wound up getting heavily into healthcare and pharma. And we were then just on this great path over the next, call it, you know, 10 to 15 years of really growing the business. We opened up three other facilities, as you mentioned. So we had four, you know, as we got into the mid 90s. And we really were primarily at that point a qualitative data collection company focused at that point in time on in-person research. And it was great. I mean, our client lists grew, our facilities grew, they expanded. We had great coverage. My sister, Debbie, ran our LA facility. And you know, of course, because we were in New York, New Jersey, LA, not only were we doing a lot of pharma work, but we were also doing a lot of media work as well, you know, being the fact that we were in those two markets. And, you know, the business grew and we were up to about 10 million plus in revenue at that period of time. At that point, I started getting more and more calls from what I would call venture capital groups and small private equity companies. And, you know, there was an interest in using us as a platform to then grow further. At that stage, I was still relatively young, thought there was a lot more room to grow the business. And in, I think it was 1999, I connected with, then became my partner, Mike Sullivan. And Mike was not from our industry, but had a real set of important skills for our business. He came from the hospitality world. He was very great financial acumen and operational skills. And I was much more of a client facing and industry guy. So, you know, Mike came in as a partner, and we then went out in the early 2000s and really accelerated the growth of the platform and wound up ultimately building a business, not just through organic growth, but through acquisitions. We made a series of acquisitions in Europe, and a couple technology acquisitions. And now we really had what I would call a best-in-class set of assets that, you know, no one could really rival. And that was really what I call the third chapter of the story, this time between 2000 and 2015, 16, where we really just were, you know, really just having this great growth trajectory and really transforming the business qualitatively. We're doing a lot more digitally at that point in time as well. And we started dabbling in quant, but we really weren't all that big of a quant player, but we knew that there was a great opportunity in front of us. And that really leads to the fourth chapter of the story. You know, around 2016, 17, we have this opportunity. How do we want to go and sort of create the next growth path? And that's when we went out and we sought a real institutional investor and went through a process to find that right partner. And we found him in Gage Capital. Gage came in 2019. And you know, when you think about where we were in 2019 to where we are now in 2024, in about 4.5 years, we've doubled the size of the business. But more than doubling the size of the business is we've really reshaped the business and transformed the business to be a business much more equally balanced in qual and quant, much more focused on delivering tech-enabled, digital, and productized opportunities for our clients and servicing our clients different today than what we did historically, you know, in those first probably four decades.
You make the story sound so easy, Steve. Now, surely it didn't unfold as easy as all that. Tell me about some of the setbacks, some of the frustrations, some of the failures that you had, kind of like on that journey.
Absolutely. So it's really interesting. You know, I've always been blessed with this opportunity to build a business over a series of years. I think that is one of the challenges of today's market is that everybody's looking to build sizable businesses really fast. And it's really challenging to do that. And I think that's why you see, great successes, but you also see a whole bunch of failures along the way too, because this idea that you're not taking one step after another, one building block after another, you're really forced to really do it in a highly accelerated way. Not always the easiest thing to do. I look back and I think about surviving the dot-com bubble and bust. And, thankfully we weren't so highly engaged in the dot-com world in 2000, but we had a lot of work in that area and we surely took a hit. We had to get to the other side of it. I think of the great financial crisis of 08 and 09 and sort of the impact that that had on the business. I think about COVID, and you got to remember, for us, COVID was devastating. I mean, we had a huge in-person business, even though we had transformed. It was still probably $90 million of revenue that, on the snap of one day, March 13th, I'll never forget it, went to zero. It literally went to zero. Now, it eventually came back, and today it's a healthy business, but nowhere near what it was like pre-COVID, And then you could look at the economic times that we've been through over the last, call it 12 to 18 months, which have been more challenging. So this idea that you have to find ways to navigate through the challenges, you've got to persevere, you've got to lean on your team. And I think one of the lessons there is really around understanding what's going on, recognizing that none of this is going to be solved by yourself. It's going to be a team that's going to get it done, and you have to rely on the talents of your team and the resilience of your team to do it. And then you've also got to really make sure that you've got your ears out and your eyes open to what's going on out there and what are other people experiencing and how do you measure up against that and utilize some of that learning to just be better day in and day out. And that should be also during good times as well. So it hasn't always been a straight line. It shouldn't be a straight line. There should be ups and downs. There should be failures along the way. And then we should be getting better off of our failures and learning from them. And I think the thing that served me the best along the way is taking risks, but making sure I understand those risks as well as possible and measuring them up and being as calculated as I can be, but never stopping, no matter how many setbacks I might have. And then also recognizing that I've got to complement myself with as much talent as possible, because really that's what drives the success. It's not about me, it's about the team,
That's
it's
so
about the
true.
work we're
That's so
doing with our
true.
partners. And, partnerships are critical in this. I mean, I think about all of the clients that we partner with, all of the colleagues, some would call them competitors. I think of them more as colleagues and, sort of how they help me grow and find success. I think about, relationships I built, like with the Time Warner Media Lab as an example, where we were working with them day in and day out and running that lab and learning along with them how to work to provide great media research. I think about the work we've done in pharma with some of our wonderful clients in building out audiences and looking for hard to find patients. And I look at, the partnerships we've had with technology partners along the way as well. So all of this happens, what's the saying? It takes a village. It surely does take a village.
Yeah, clients are wonderful partners to grow and learn with. It's true, you're doing the research for them, but of course, you learn along the way as
Absolutely.
well. Now, you talked about one of the ways that you were really able to navigate through those turbulent times was because you had this ear to the industry. And I want to explore that a little bit further because, we are an industry, but we're also a community, and we're a relatively small community. It's not like we're a huge community. We're a relatively small community. What I really love about one of your initiatives to kind of like help facilitate that community and to, again, keep that ear to the ground is the CEO Summit that you host every year. Maybe you could talk a little bit both about the CEO Summit specifically, but more broadly about us as a community and how we're evolving and how you see us changing over the course of these past few decades.
Absolutely. So yeah, the CEO Summit is near and dear to my heart. My good friend Merrill Dubreuil and I started this about 17 years ago or so. And The whole idea really was off of this concept that we wanted to provide a forum for people who are running research companies to talk not just about research and methodologies, but talk about what it's like to run a business. And part of what makes us successful is not just doing good research, but it's how we run a business, how we build culture, how we build strategy, how we think about our teams, attracting and retaining talent. All of these things are critical to the success of a business. So we wanted to create a forum where people could really learn and talk about these things together as a group. And it's one of the proudest parts of my career is this summit that we've sort of built over these years. And it didn't start off year one as being that, but over the course of a series of years, what it became was this real community of research leaders who could come and share and do it in a very open and honest way. We call it 3 days of therapy. And I think that that's pretty accurate in the sense of, people really, sort of, have this cathartic experience of laying it out there and having their colleagues help them and, work through the challenges. And not only does it work in those 3 days, but it creates friendships and relationships that carry on throughout the year. And that to me is incredibly important. I mean, how nice is it to be able to call a half a dozen colleagues and say, I'm working through a problem. Have you experienced this before? What have you done? And I really believe that it makes us stronger as an industry. If you think about what we do, we engage the public in a variety of ways to give opinions. We work with our clients to give them useful, important data to make big business decisions. The better that we can do that as a collective, the more that people will be willing to share their data, but also the more willing that clients will have to fight for budgets to actually do research. And this all works hand in hand. I mean, we have had lots of clients come in and talk at the summit. We've had respondents come and talk at the summit. But the most important thing is we've created this forum for sharing. And Merrill and I stepped back last year, and we've got two other colleagues, Seema Vass and Isaac Rogers, who have taken the baton and really running with it. And Merrill and I still engage, and we're there and present. But we hope this lasts, for many, many decades to come and continues to evolve and thrive because we do think it's an important forum for our industry.
As a community, how do you think we're changing?
Well, look, I think the thing that's interesting to me is that the community is filled with new members now. The folks who are coming in and working in our industry, and this has been happening probably for the last decade plus, but I think it's happening more and more every year, are filled with, data experts, scientists, AI, ML, people who are working in user experience, employee experience, neuroscience. And I think it's really important that the community is well grounded in what research is about. But I think it's really important that we embrace all the changes that are going on so that we can continue to evolve this community to be richer and more interesting. And we're all learning from one another and, sharing old practices and things that are rooted in the ethics of good quality research. And then also understanding the new methods that are coming up and how they become important in the landscape of insights.
Yeah, I think, as you say, we're a community and we're a community of friends. And one of the things that's been very hard, at least for me personally, has just been seeing so many phenomenal, great, researchers at great companies get transitioned out of their roles. And it's been really heartbreaking to see, particularly, like I say, because you know what the quality of the work is that they do. And it's just dizzying how fast everything seems to be changing.
Yeah, I mean, change is accelerating more and more every year. And I think that what was the statement that was made was we used to do strategic planning every 5 years, then it became every 3 years. Now it's pretty much every year. And frankly, I think most people who are even doing it once a year are sort of testing and kicking the tires on the strategy every quarter at least. And I think it's just because we're in a very, hyper accelerated changing environment. And we just need to be aware of that. And the better we are at learning and understanding the change, the better we're equipped to sort of manage through it and navigate it so that we don't wind up being displaced or irrelevant to our clients.
Now, another way that you engage with community is you engage kind of like with the broader global community, I guess you could say, in terms of giving back to community. And this is something that's really very impressive, Steve. I think every organization really needs to think about how they want to give back to community. And you were one of the co-founders of the Market Research Education Foundation, which is kind of like, I guess, your approach to giving back to community. So tell us a little bit about how that started and what it is you do.
Absolutely. So MREF, Market Research Education Foundation, was founded about 10 years ago. It was a number of industry leaders, really spearheaded by myself, along with Jim Bryson, who at the time ran an organization called 2020 Research, and Steve Quirks, whose family ran Quirks, which is not just the publication, but all the conferences. And both people, along with me, have a real strong sort of philanthropic desire. And we really thought it would be interesting to sort of get a group of industry leaders and organizations to sort of come together and create a collective of giving. And we formed MREF, and the whole mission of MREF is really to help children around education and really those who are in need. So we've done a variety of initiatives over the last decade, everything from helping the Joseph School in Haiti by sponsoring a class of 20 plus students there, and as well as helping them construct part of their school, to an orphanage in Costa Rica. We helped with children refugees in the Ukraine during the war there. And then we're obviously working with a variety of organizations in Canada, as well as the US, in terms of giving grants to a variety of different places around literacy programs, around school supplies, backpacks. The whole goal for us is really to just try to find places where we can lean in and help. And the goal is not just to write checks. Of course, that's important, and we want to do that on an annual basis, but we also want to provide service where we can. So we make trips to Haiti, to Costa Rica, to a number of schools throughout the U.S., and we try to provide service, and we try to do that as a group. I just was in the Bronx last month reading to kindergartners and second graders with five other research colleagues. How cool is that to do and be a part of? And,
so cool.
What a wonderful way to spend the day. I think we want to get more and more people involved. Obviously, if anybody's interested, reach out to me. There's a whole host of us that serve on the board, the executive board, as well as a broader board of people. And we've got hundreds of people who are giving every year, and we're giving away between $200,000 and $300,000 every year. So it's really meaningful work. We're doing good as an industry. I think it's important for us to do this work. I mean, we work with the public every day, so why not give back and help them? And I think it really says something about our cottage community that we can come together and do this good work in the world. So, I'm hoping others lean in, and we'd love to have you aboard. And I'm excited about the work we're doing, and I'm hoping we'll continue to do this work for a long time to come.
Fantastic. And I think it just tells a story that every organization really needs to think about how it wants to approach, its get contribution, its giving back to community. So fantastic job. Keep up the good work there.
Thank you.
Now, Steve, you talked earlier about change and how change is accelerating. And really the qual industry in particular has seen so much change since COVID in particular. So in your game, you're seeing a lot of change for sure. What do you see as the future for this kind of research?
So I think in general, we're in a really, not just interesting time, but a very dynamic time in terms of what's going to happen in the insights world over the next probably 5 to 10 years. I think how fast it happens, I think, will depend on how quickly clients adapt new ways of looking at information and how it's delivered to them. But I think that with sort of the focus on AI, and all of the data that's accessible now and the learning off of that data, I think we're going to find, clients leaning in differently to how they not just access information, but how they action off that information. And I think there's going to be some changes in terms of both the winners and the losers along the landscape in terms of who survives, who thrives, who may wind up not being as relevant as time goes on. And all of this is going to happen relatively fast. And I don't think it's going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months, although there'll be changes over the next 6 to 12 months. But I think that if you don't have a perspective on this, you're probably going to miss out. And if you don't consider it as part of what your thinking is as you build your longer term strategy, I think you're going to close off opportunities that could be very interesting and frankly create a lot of success for you. And I think people need to start thinking more broadly about this, not just about the technology, not just about the data, but who they're working with, how their company exists today and how it might exist in the future. Should they be partnering with people? Should they be merging with people? Should they acquire people or should they sell to somebody and work within that construct? I think it's going to be an interesting time. And I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunity out there. And I think it'll be interesting to see who takes advantage of that. I also think as what has happened over the last 5 or 6 years will happen even more so in the next 5 to 6 years is the influx of new players. I think about some of my competitors today. They didn't exist a decade ago. And that's cool. I think that's a really good thing. It keeps, sort of legacy companies like mine on our toes and making sure that we're evolving. But what it shows is that there's great opportunity out there. And I think the same thing's going to happen in the next decade, which is we're going to see other new players come in and probably some other players move away. So I just think that this is a time where there's some shakeup that's going to happen. There's going to be some movement of methodology and technology. And I think it'll be interesting to look at 5 to 10 years from now compared to where we are today.
You raise a really good point. It sounds like you're suggesting that what you did yesterday is not necessarily what you're going to do tomorrow. And so sitting down and thinking about yourself that way is not going to be all that helpful. So all organizations really need to sit down here and do some assessment about how they kind of like adapt to all the change that's at work.
And I would add one thing to that, Duane, which is I really believe you have to have self-awareness when you're really understanding this and thinking through it, because not everybody has the appetite to change. Not everybody wants to go through that transformation or has the resources to do it. And I think that's okay. That's a fair assessment. So, when you're going through this evaluation of what do you do next, I think you do need to think through and be honest about it and recognize that there's lots of different ways to have good outcomes. They don't always need to be, I need to be the next AI guru out there.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, Steve, we close every interview with the same question, which is, if you were giving advice to people entering into the industry today, what advice would you give them?
Well, first off, I love this industry. I really do. I've loved it for probably ever in terms of, how I've thought about it and how I've worked my way through it. And, so much of that is around the colleagues, the friends that I've, relationships that I've built throughout all these years. I would tell you it's an amazing place to work. It's changing, it's transforming. There's a lot of interesting things happening. It matters in terms of what we do in the world and how business decisions are made, and ultimately the products and services that you see out there, you become a part of. I encourage all younger people to get engaged in this world of insights and research if they have an interest in it. I also think that there's great opportunity in it, and the opportunities are going to be constantly changing and evolving, which makes it an interesting place to play. So I think lean in, learn, ask questions, put yourself out there, and I think wonderful things are possible. And I hope that you have some form of enjoyment that I've had, because the enjoyment that I've had over the last almost 4 decades now has been incredible. And I feel ridiculously blessed is the easiest way to say it.
Well, and we've been fortunate as an industry to have you. So thank you, Steve, again for all
Thank
your
you.
contributions to the industry. So yeah, thanks for joining us on Legends of Media Research.
Thank you, Duane. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to the audience for joining us today on Legends of Media Research. Don't forget to tune into our next episode. And if you'd like to hear a message from Media Science, Stay tuned till the end of the episode. Until then, I'm Dr. Dwayne Vran, CEO of Media Science, thanking you for joining us today.
Almost every major innovation in the TV advertising industry over the course of the past decade was first tested by media science researchers. Whether you're talking about video ads on mobile phones, or limited interruption ad pods, or program context effects, or brand integrations, or pause ads, or picture-in-picture ads, or six-second ads, or interactive ad formats. I mean, the list goes on and on. All were first tested by media science. Media science is the leader in media innovation research. So when you're looking for media or advertising innovation research, collaborate with media science. Learn more at mediascience.com.